and he's going to talk about towards the resolution of the CGHS singularity in loop quantum gravity. So go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you hear me good?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So today I'm just going to talk about the work we are doing with, in collaboration with Alejandro Corici, Arcelis Arami, and Juan Daniel Perez from UNAM, and Javier Olmedo from Universidad de la República in Uruguay. Okay, so slide number 2, please. This is the outline. So we first start by the introduction and motivation of the work, and then maybe we go through a brief review of the CGHS black hole, and then there will be studying the classical relation between 3+1 and the CGHS, then the quantization about kinematical energy space, and solving the constraints and simulated resolution. And then some other comments at the end. Next study, number 3, and number 4. So, first of all, I should mention that this work is heavily based on the work of Gambini-Pulin, and then Gambini-Pulin and Olmedo for the 3+1 expected symmetric case. They did the same thing for this resolution of the singularity in this expected symmetric model. I should say that there are many similar elements in our work and their work. For example, the kinematical difference is kind of essentially the same. Many of the important results of the typical sector, like most of the things about Hilbert space, properties of solutions, etc., are also very similar, or sometimes are the same. Also, they found two new observables that we also find here that they are also identical. So because in many parts of this work we're closely or identically following the linear arguments and reproducing the results, so, reproducing the results that they derived for the CGHS case, one might ask, really, is doing this for the CGHS really useful or interesting, or does it have any new thing? Next slide, please, number 5. So first of all, to answer this, at least our motivation, first note that an important reason for this similarity is the way that we can test CGHS in some similar variables to the Bojovsky variables of 3+1 expected symmetry case. Because of this, the Hamiltonian will become very similar in this formulation, and thus it relates to some of our motivations. So again, what we're doing is what is useful or interesting. Regarding the previous note I said, so as soon as we heard about the results, nice results of Gambini and Pulin and Olmedo, we thought that it could be applied to the CGHS because we had this similar Hamiltonian. And then we wanted to see actually if it really goes down in detail, because maybe we can guess from the outset, but you might not be certain. Then the next item is that although one can guess that, you can get the same main results for the CGHS, again, because of the similarity, nevertheless, it's not completely certain or convincing from the outset until one shows it explicitly. Maybe the central important reason of our motivation is that we're planning to follow this analysis for the CGHS with matter. So it means that we'll do loop quantization and studying the back reaction, etc., if it's possible to do it. This work that we are doing now, presenting now for the vacuum, this would be a good warm-up for the case with matter. Also, it gives us better understanding of possible challenges and possibilities in the details of the case with matter. Next slide, number 6. So, other things that, if you have an interesting result from a loop quantum gravity, why not have it for two models instead of one model? Apart from all these, the CGHS itself is an interesting model. It has like whole solution, hospitalization, etc. But it's relatively simple and relatively solvable, even in the presence of matter. So one has to be able to proceed more in quantization compared to more complicated models. Also, there are detailed studies and the matter theorists work. There are many results in the literature that might somehow connect to the quantum gravity analysis of the model. After we do this quantum gravity analysis, maybe find some relations, some previous works in some respects. Particularly, for example, the work of Ashkatar, Pritzelius, and Ravanoglu, that was interesting results, very interesting studying, result about evaporation of the black hole by correction, asymptotic properties of the space time. But at the same time, it was minted approximation and not quantization, it was semi-classical, and it was not entirely analytical. So it might be nice to have some analytical results, about the resolution of singularity, in addition to these numerical nice results. Then also, it would be nice to demonstrate these interesting results for this popular model, if that's the variety of results we already have for the CGHS. At the end, there is one note that there are some rather important differences which we mentioned along the way, which makes CGHS not exactly the same as the 3+1 expected metric system. So some results might have looked the same, but might be conceptually or conceptually different in the sense that the interpretation of some of the results might be different. And maybe it gives us more insight. Next slide, number 80. So this is a brief preview of the CGHS black hole. CGHS, as I think many of you or all of you might know, it's a two-dimensional dilatomic model that equation 1 gives its pure gravitational Lagrangian. Now, here in equation 1 of the Dilaton field, and you see that it's now minimally coupled to the scalar curvature and the four-angle squared is the cosmological constant. Now, in conformal gauge and in double node coordinates, you have this form of the metric in double node coordinates and in conformal gauge, and the solution, the form of the metric is equation number 2, and the solutions are equation number 3. M there in equation 3 is a constant of integration that turns out to be the ADM or Bondinac if you calculate at the non-infinitive Bondinac or spatial infinitive ADM. So in equation number 4 you see the form of the scalar curvature of the CGHS, and it's obvious from 4 that it corresponds to a black hole of mass M that is located at x plus x minus equal m over lambda cube. Next slide, please. Number 9. So this is a crystal diagram of the vacuum CGHS black hole. You can see that it's very similar to the crystal diagram of the Schwarzschild. These are x plus minus equal 0 are the future and past event horizons, the left and right. Okay, next slide, number 11, we are going to study the classical form of CGHS and 3+1 and their relations and how they can be derived from a generic two-dimensional dilatomic model. So we are in slide number 11. One can write the most general diffeomorphism invariant action using such an order differential equation for the metric G and the scalar dilatomic with phi as in equation 6. Here you see that y of phi is a function of the Dilaton field, phi is the Dilaton field here, and y of phi is the function of the Dilaton field, which is the non-minimal coupling term. Then d phi is called the Dilaton potential, and you have a Dilaton kinetic term there, which you can remove it at will, if you want, by a conformal transformation. Then in equation 7 and 8, you can see that both CGHS and 3+1 can be cast in this form, and also, they look very similar, and maybe the main difference might be the form of the dilatomic potential in both terms, in both models. Then, as a result, we see that their Hamiltonian also is very similar, And that was what actually we thought that the singularity could be applied, this singularity resolution method could be applied to the CGHS almost immediately. Next slide, please, number 12. Now, there's a subtle difference here, although these are very similar models, in they look very similar. As you see in the 3 plus 1 in equation 10, phi is actually the part of the metric that appears in front of the two sphere in the spherical and spherical symmetric angle. While in the CGHS, it's truly a distinct degree of freedom. It's not present in the metric, and it's a scalar field that is not really coupled to gravity. So we should take extra care again in quantization, maybe representation of operators and interface space, and especially interpreting the results that we have for this variable. Next slide, number 13. We are going to see, in this slide, we explain why we did not do the conformance transformation for the CGHS case. So, as you know, for the 3 plus 1 variable, we could make a conformance transformation to get rid of the Willett and kinetic curve. We could do the same for the CGHS, and in fact, almost all of the analysis that I have seen have done that. But then we decided that at least we can do it without the conformance transformation. Let's do it like that. And the main idea was that variables are directly geometric, and there's no need to take extra care at the end, and you can directly interpret the variables, and there's no fiducial metric and all that. But it's just a choice. You can choose not to do that and remove the conformance transformation. Next slide, number 14. So here we are comparing a 3 plus 1 and CGHS case, a 3 plus 1 is very symmetric, the canonical variables when you write them in case for variables, they are monads and one dimensional sets of monads. You can see that in the left part for the 3 plus 1 is symmetric case, the variables we get are xi, which are two variables, are those 1 and 2, that is, sorry, the hyperbol, and omega 1. So omega 1 is the spin connection that is for a hypersurface. X, 1, and 2 are the components, actually xi is the, when we started with the Lagrangian formulation, we added the portion free condition multiplied by a Lagrange multiplier to the action. And this HR was the Lagrange multiplier at the beginning, but then we did an integration by part, and this became one of the variables. So we are still in the left part. You see that we have three momenta, P1, P2, and P omega, and P1 and P2 are related to the components of the normal to the special hypersurface, and P omega is related to the non-minimal coupling term of the Willett. Equation 11 and 12. Now we go to the right part for the CGHS. In this formation, we have the same variables, but we have a new variable, which is the Dilaton field, and that's the direct result of the fact that we didn't commit the kinetic term of the Dilaton field, because when you have that d mu phi there, it's the time you have the time derivative of phi there, so it becomes one of the variables, canonical variables. Now in 13, 14, and 15, you see the canonical momenta to these variables, and we have a new momentum, which is P5, as you see there. Now, the next item, under the boxes, you see that because we didn't do conformance transformation, as I said, the Dilaton kinetic term was present, and so was phi dot, and then phi is a variable. And then equation 14 would be a new primary constraint. So we have a new constraint for the CGHS case. Next slide, please. So we want now to make a canonical transformation from the previous variables and the form of these models to the global variables. In the left part, we see that After doing this, we are transferring to the two variables, Kx, Ex, and known variables, Kpi, Pi, and Q, Pi, Eta. So, what we did actually, I just want to show how they're related and where does this transformation come from. So, from the Q+1 case, you have this Q+1 metric, you have these variables, and you just have to kind of educated get these relations. As you see in 17, we have this nice relation between P squared, which is the norm of P, and P by the canonical conjugate to HI squared, that is X1 squared and X2 squared in the previous slide. So in 17 here, you see that we have this relation between P and the determinant of the spatial metric. So first of all, in 18, we just kind of rename P omega to E. And then in 19, this is obvious from 17, you can 19 is kind of obvious, and 20 and 21 are also kind of come natural because you have the number of p, and you know that p minus squared minus 2 squared should be 4 times the determinant of metric, and you have that, and that's kind of very natural form of this. Now, if you follow the same line of analysis, the same line of educated gates for the CDHS, it comes also very natural. You use the score of the metric, the score of the determinant of, you use the determinant of the spatial metric, and then you have the 23, which is just renaming of the momentum of the spin connection, spatial spin connection, and then 24 is obvious, and 25 and 6 come from again 22, as the same way that we have for the 3+1. Next slide, please. So, now, after this transformation, we have these variables. In the left box, we are left only with Kx, Ex, Kpi, and Epi, and I have not written eta and qeta because, as I say in the next item in the left box, we make a gauge fixation of eta equals 1, and this together with the Gauss constraint, our second class, we can fix the Gauss constraint because of that. And so you have fixed eta, and from Gauss constraint you find q eta, and then those terms are gone. And then you get the 28, which is the Hamiltonian of a total constraint system, last multiplied by Hamiltonian or scalar constraint, and shift multiplied by the Hamiltonian constraint. In the left, in the right box, you see that we have kind of the same pair of canonical variables, but we have phi and qphi in addition to kxx and kphi e phi. Now, remember that especially when we see later that EX is not really a monad, one of the triads of monads. We see it later, but the name of the form of these are similar. Here is the name of this variable. So, again, to make a gauge fixing, we arrive at 30, which is Hamiltonian constraint, which is Hamiltonian constraint, but we have that new constraint that we saw in the previous. Now, because of this case fixing that we did in the right part, we see that Kx is actually the spin connection of the special hyper in the special hypersurface, which is not the case in the 3+1. And so this is a kind of important point to have in mind. Okay, so let's. Next slide, number 17. Since we have this new constraint, we have to preserve it, and this leads to another constraint, which we call alpha. And it turned out that alpha and mu are second class together, so we have to proceed with the standard way to treat the second class system. We solve these two constraints. So we find phi and d5 from them, and so we don't have phi and d5 in the Hamiltonian anymore because we have substituted them in terms of other variables. Now also we should introduce direct brackets and follow by the direct brackets. And as you see in, for example, 36, the direct brackets do not have the so-called standard form, like, for example, kx and k5 should be 0 in a standard form, but we don't have this here. It makes calculations a little bit complicated, but we have kind of a resolution for this. In the next slide, number 18, the total Hamiltonian in here, as you see in 39, is after doing this second class procedure, is now we are left with Hamiltonian constraints and Hamiltonian constraints, Lapson shift. In equation 40, you see the canonical curves that appear in the Hamiltonian now. And in equation 41, is what I said before, we introduced this new variable, Ux instead of Kx. And just for introducing that, you see in 42 that the Dirac bracket become turning the standard for. So this is, I mean, very useful for the calculations you don't have those extra terms. Next is slide number 19, please. So the next step is because we want to prepare the CGHS for the Dirac quantization. So we have to turn the algebra of the function into the algebra. What we do is by restating that and shift. First we restate shift in the way in equation 43, then we restate that in equation 44. And what this does is that, as you see in 45, in equation 45, it leads to the Hamiltonian constraint, it becomes a total derivative, as you see here. So with one time you just integrate it by part, and you have just three terms there instead of more like general terms that you have without, you know, integrating by part. So in equation 46, you see that this condition that we have, the total derivative, the Hamiltonian constraint being a total derivative, this leads to equation 46, which means that the Dirac bracket of Hamiltonian constraint with itself is as strong as zero. And thus, now in equation 47, we have a Lie algebra, as you see, because we have the first two from before and the second one, the Hamiltonian constraint with itself, now is zero, and then the Dirac quantization can be pursued. Okay, but question 20, please. Slide 20. Now, the one last step, because the fourth quantization is to prepare the Hamiltonian constraint in a form that is suitable for quantization. So we integrate it by part, as I said before. You get an n-bar prime, n-bar of the restate labs, and then you integrate by part, you get the prime there. You rename it to n, and we scale n by this, the second line, as you see, this form. Then we get an H that is suitable for our purposes, for example, operator ordering and representation in 48. The GM that you see there, the third term in the bracket, this appears because of the imposing of the boundary condition for the last for the Hamiltonian function to be differentiable, functionally differentiable, and that comes from there. Just to be complete, we put in 49, we put the form of the 3+1 Hamiltonian constraint that Gambinian couldn't use for the work. And you see there are many similarities, but there are some, you cannot see from the output that exactly the same results are going to be there. Okay, next slide please, number 22. So here we start the quantization procedure. As I said before, the CDHS and Sprinkler-1 in this case are identically the same, the Hilbert effect. Of course, in the beginning we had some doubts because EX, as I tell you in a few slides forward, I'm telling you, EX is actually not the triad or not the monad, it's a Dilakhan field. And classically, it's a Dilakhan field, it's the square of a Dilakhan field. And thus, it's not completely obvious that you can follow the standard kind of this quantization with it. But well, nevertheless, nothing is going to stop us from polymerization of the theory. So we take this polymerization in K5, as you see in the first item. Then the space of cylindrical functions are the graph these in the K representation or K and U representation of the one. This would be equation 60. You see the first item on the right hand side is the normal holonomy along the edges. And then the second one is the point holonomy. And then, well, point holonomy is naturally associated to the vertices and the normal holonomy to the edges. Here, KJ is the color of the edges, and UJ is the color of the vertices. And second, in our point polynomy, we are using this new J, which is the state values in the R. So we have this, we are dealing with coefficients or periodic functions or almost periodic functions. And thus, this means that we are dealing with non-separable integral space. So our new vector space, that the fully, well, in order to see what is our fully vector space, we see from intuitively that the holonomy, the space of point holonomies, the inverse of the point holonomies is where the functions of the four compactification of the real line with its natural invariant measure, the Haar measure, the Bohr measure. And then for the normal holonomies, we have these belong to the space of some of the functions, small or squared. And there is from the root, as we know, there is this global degree of freedom of n that is, as you see that. And then the whole space would be 51. This is the directory method of these spaces. Now to choose our spaces set, as you see in the last item, this is the space of the graph with k and mu and m. Next slide on the community. So now let's see what is the inner product. The inner product is kind of again the same in kind of a general in many of these models. This is the case. So the spin network defined in the graph G can be regarded as a spin network with support and larger graph G bar. We just can assign trivial levels to the edges and vertices which are not created in G, and that gives you G bar. Then we can for the inner product of this G and two, if you have two graphs G and G prime for the inner product, you can get G bar, which is the union of these two graphs, and then the inner product you can define as 62. So basically, these two graphs should be identical if they should. I mean, as you see here. As if you want to get a non-vanishing inner product. Regarding the slide 23, now next slide number 24, please. Okay, the next step is representing the operators. Again, CGHS and 3 plus 1 are very similar, but again, in 54, there is a caution saying that EX, again, here is not the trial, classically, it could be like that. So because of the canonical communication relations that we have, we can choose this representation, 63 to 65, and you know, E5 is the density, so you have a delta V R delta there, and M is a multiplicative an operator, and you can see that the Dirac operator also. So as I said, the next item, M is the Dirac operator, on the boundary associated to the mass of the black hole. Also, we have an operator in G66 operator associated to the holonomy that appears in the Hamiltonian constraint. And what it does is that either you see that there's a point X in G66 and X on the point X. So if point X coincides with the place of the vertex, it just shifts the colors of this vertex by plus or minus n row. But if it is not in, on a vertex, doesn't act on a vertex, it's between two vertices, it produces a new vertex between two vertices, mu j and mu j plus. Next slide, number 25. So, again, there's the representation. So, there's another thing that, again, I said here, in the CGHS case, ECH is actually the square of the Dilakam field, and you should have info about that, while involving 2 plus 1 is actually the trial component or your trial, and have information about the method. And again, I say that we have to be careful about the interpretations and applying some results, and dedicating some results. Next, slide number 26. Okay, so we arrive at the form of the Hamiltonian, quantum Hamiltonian constraint. We adopt this order and this kind of presentation. As you see, the first item in 58, the first term in 58, is a theta operator. This is motivated by the previous work and the quantum cosmology. For example, there are several work, but for example, we mentioned one of these here. It acts by means of an diagonal operator, which relates to those N5 that I said before. And in 60, you see that we can use a spectral decomposition to give 61 and 62 about P5 to over color 1/4 and sine of P5. Now in 58, we also have, as you see, 1 over P5 in the last term. And in the next slide number 27, you see that we can, as always, can use the Tiemann trick, equation 63 to represent this. You just classically have 63 and just promote them to operators. And the square of that gives us equation number 64, which is 1 over P5. So with all these in hand, we can go ahead and solve the Hamiltonian constraint. In slide number 28, you see the action of the Hamiltonian constraint on a basis vector of the kinematic of interface space. Now this gives us 65. Now the general form of this is very similar to the one that we can derive for 3+1. It's kind of, you can guess that, but not, well, we were not exactly sure that the calculation would be exactly the same because of the following properties that we mentioned. But anyway, FDS plus and F minus of 1865 are slightly different than what I haven't written the details of that, what you have inside them. But there, this is the difference between 3+1, but the following points remain the same for both of these. First of all, you can see that the first item is after 65, equation 65. You can see that the whole thing is multiplied by kj. So if kj vanishes, then the whole right hand side vanishes, and basically you have an identity. Also, f plus minus and f zero have this property that mu j, if you have mu j equals zero, then all of these three f vanish. So basically, well, as I said, these are the same also, these properties are the same for the plus one, especially in symmetric case. So basically, if you have mu j equals zero or kj equals zero, both of them equal to zero, this is kind of trivial, this is an element. Let's call this space with this property, the last item on 5.8, because we kept g and zero, which is stands as a generic notation for the space with k or mu equal zero both. Next slide, number 29. So here comes the singularity resolution. So this is space that we mentioned, the k, g, and zero, they have finite now. So what we saw that previously, that they are just kind of trivial, they give an identity there. So all these means that we can decouple them, but also by means of group averaging at the end. And then the physical inverse space would be decoupled from them. They would not be present in the physical inverse. And the physical inverse space will be only left with the ordinal complement of these states. And so we don't have these. This is on one hand, we don't have these on the physical inverse space. On the other hand, equation 56 gives us the value operator for the CGHS model, which is proportional to the square root of the Sullivan's metric, and that is the integral of that. But that is proportional to E file and then just E file. So you have this mu j there. And you can see that since the physical inverse space does not contain any state with mu j or kj, mu j or kj for zero, mu j is more important for us here, then there is no singularity state present in the quantum world. So this is also the way that Gambini and Poulin do it. That in 3+1 also you have the square root of kj in the volume, but you don't have that. Slide number 30. So let's look at some of the properties of the solutions that, again, is shared between CGHS and 3+1. So we are assuming that the states that are annihilated by the quantum Hamiltonian constraints belong to the dual algebraic dual of the space of cylindrical functions, We can write them like this, as you see. Psi here is related to the, or analog of the Cooper's mass wave function. And chi is just an arbitrary function on the kinematical interface space with finite norm. And then you have those phi here. The action of the Hamiltonian quantum Hamiltonian constraint on these, as you see in the second item, this gives a set of equations, one for each vertex, one for each region, which you can see in equation 68. Now, because of that, we can have this natural decomposition that we see in 69. And as you see here, and maybe from previous equations, for example, from 65, but also here, this action, and was the last item in page 30, this action does not use different graphs, because the subspace associated with the given graph is preserved by the action of the Hamiltonian or scalar constraint, such that no new vertices are created and no new vertices are created. So, next slide number 30, please. So, looking at the question 65, which you can find in slide 28, you see in 65, in equation 65, in slide 28, that you have this Hamiltonian constraint mixes these three states, mu plus 4oj and mu minus 4oj. Let's go again to the slide 31. So, from there, you can see that the underreaction of H, first of all, the color of H is preserved. And then the color of it is mixed, but it's mixed in the way that it's by means of different operator of the step 4 row in the layer of UJ, the color of the vertex. So I can see again from there, from 65, equation 65, that the Hamiltonian constraint only mixes the state with support in the lattices of the layer of UJ, new J that have a set of 4. Also the functions at plus minus, we haven't written their form there, but they also vanish on the interval 0 to minus 4, respectively, if plus vanishes at minus 0 to minus 2, or minus the other way, and that owes to the sine functions that appear inside the plus F minus. The sign of FGN function. So because of this, item number 3, you see in slide number 31, because of this, the different orientation of the label in UJ are decoupled. Also, the other thing is that item number 4, that the solution is begun because of these, as you can see here, the solution is begun to subspace with support and the semi messages. Nu j equals epsilon j plus minus 4n rho, which n now belongs to the national numbers, and epsilon j goes from 0 to 4 rho. And because of this last item, the constraint unrelated states belong to separable solid spaces of kinematical Hilbert space, which is kind of happens also in the quantum cosmology. So, slide number 32. So, this is the work, the detail that remain to, be understood more and, calculated explicitly. This is also a warm-up again for the K-speed method. So, I think to complete the analysis of this part for the Hamiltonian constraint, you can apply the group algorithm to the aforementioned state to find the solutions of the constraint. As you see here, this is a group algorithm, which is the Hamiltonian constraint. The exponential you see in equation 70, lambda j cj, well, that cj is the different operator appearing in the Hamiltonian constraint. Also, as you know, group algorithm also induces an inner product, so then we have an inner product on each space. Slide number 33. The other thing after that is that then we should find the diffeomorphic invariant subspace of the critical space, and this is achieved by group aversion now registered to the diffeomorphic constraint. Now, as you see, to find the critical sector, we should use both of the symmetries and some of the scalars of symmetries and the diffeomorphic symmetry. So this is the last step that you should do. These procedures are averaging to study the thermophysical environment states, obviously, and also, again, it induces a natural linear product on the resulting vector space of these states. Now, in the CGHS, the second bullet item in the slide 33, I should mention there is only one dimension, a special dimension in the CGHS. So because of that, the deformational constant averages the space on the only available, which we call the radial direction. And because of that, the resulting space of deformational invariant space will be given by linear combination of string networks with vertices in a possible position along the radial line. Now, then, as is usual in the quantum gravity, the corresponding deformational invariant vertical space, the basic state of that space would be class of deformational invariant graph. In each class, you can characterize the graphs by coloring and coloring of the edges and vertices. And this space, as is known, they call ESMA. ESMA space. Slide number 34, please. There are also, in this slide, we are going to mention two new observables that is originally derived by Zambini and Pulley. The first item is that you see, because we have this symmetry group of the graph, so the order of the position of the vertices of the deformational invariant state is preserved in the sense that you cannot pass these points, these vertices past each other because it's one dimensional and deformational doesn't do that. The next item is that the coloring of the edges. And the order of the vertices is also preserved, as you see before. So we can identify two new strictly quantum observables in the bulk, and it's strictly quantum, they're going to present in the classical theory, related to this above these two previous points. First of all, it's kind of simply the number of vertices of a graph, because I'm a thermal constraint, if you remember, it didn't create any new vertices. In experiment 1, you see that we introduce this N of V, which acting on the physical space gives you just a fixed number of vertices of a graph of that space. And there's another observable, which we call O, which is associated to the order of vertices in the graph. You can define it like this would be a function of between 0 and 1, I divide the parameter between 0 and 1, which value is there. And then if it acts in the physical space, it gives you basically the integer part of the, you see that the color of the integer part of the MU. So this is another observable that we have both in 2 plus 1 and CGHS. So next slide, please. This is the summary. As we saw, as a result of the variables we have chosen for the CGHS, this kind of bourgeois variable for the CGHS, the Hamiltonian constraint, or the full Hamiltonian actually, is written in a very similar form to the reflexional space symmetric. Not completely similar, but very similar. This allows us to extend the work of the Hamiltonian or model to the vacuum case. And this allows us to resolve the similarity of the CGHS and obtain new observables that also are present in the physical function. Now, many of the aspects of these analogies are similar or identical to physical functions, as you saw, as I mentioned before, but there are also some mathematical and some conceptual issues about CGHS that we should understand better ourselves in our group. Also, again, as I mentioned before, there are some important differences, especially related to the Dirac field, not the metric. But then there are maybe some subtleties there. Also, just as a note here, the work by if I remember correctly, Sian Frani, they showed that the area operator in the cases coupled to the Dirac field, minimally, you have 1 over 5 or 5 squared, the spectrum of the area would include 1 over 5 squared. So, I mean, this is kind of a little bit subtle case here in EHC. And the last item on slide 35 is that now this is our main hope, that we're going to apply this to the CJHS big matter with our work as kind of warm up. And this is not just to mention the challenges, some of the challenges. This is more complicated for several reasons, as you may know many of them. But among them is maybe the most visible and obvious one is that the form of the Hamiltonian constraint is such that when you have matter, you cannot integrate by parts your Hamiltonian constraints, the gravitational part. So more terms, they're more complicated, and then the representation and ordering of these in quantum level would be much more involved. So thank you very much.
Questions?
I have a question. I'm confused about this global M degree of freedom, because it seems that you first introduced it in the quantization section, and I'm wondering what's conjugate to it. Do you need this M to reconstruct the metric from the other variables? I just was interested in some clarification.
I'm sorry, could you repeat it again? Sorry.
What? Sorry. When you introduced the quantization, you introduced this part of your kinematical Hilbert space involves this global degree of freedom M. And that, but when you summarized the classical canonical theory, I didn't notice this M. This global M degree of freedom, and I was just wondering where this came from exactly.
Right, the M actually came from, as I kind of maybe mentioned, if you want, it comes from the boundary condition. I mean, if you want the Hamiltonian classic, the Hamiltonian to be functionally differentiable, then it turns out that you have to add an term to this at infinity, which is turned out to be GN, or NGN. So in classical world, that comes from the...
Okay.
Other questions? If not, let's thank the speaker again.